Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the nation's Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, acting as Trump's hatchet man as he conducts a purge of the FBI to validate Trump's narrative that the special counsel's investigation into Trump's Russia ties and obstruction of justice are a Democratic-inspired witch hunt by a bunch of sore losers out to delegitimize Trump's glorious victory in the Electoral College. Asher Rangappa, Associate Dean at Yale Law School and a former special agent at the FBI specializing in counterintelligence, joins us to discuss how Sessions has leaned on the Trump-appointed FBI Director Christopher Wray to fire the Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe and the FBI's former General Counsel James Baker, both of whom were close to the fired FBI Director James Comey and are witnesses in possible obstruction of justice charges against Trump. We will also examine warnings given to Jared Kushner from the FBI that his friend Wendy Deng, the former wife of Rupert Murdoch, could be working for the Chinese. Then we'll speak with Peter Stone, a special correspondent for McClatchy DC Bureau, who since 1990 has covered a wide array of lobbying, legal and campaign finance issues in Washington, about his article at McClatchy with Greg Gordon, FBI investigating whether Russian money went to NRA to help Trump. We will look into an FBI inquiry into a former Russian senator with ties to organized crime who was close to Putin, suspected of funneling money through the National Rifle Association to help elect Trump. Then finally, we'll speak with Alexander Hertel Fernandez, a professor of international and public affairs at Columbia University, who is a co-author of a new study at the National Bureau of Economic Research, From the Bargaining Table to the Ballot Box, Political Effect of Right-to-Work Laws. We will discuss how the increase in the number of states adopting right-to-work laws has hurt Democrats by diminishing their fundraising, their ability to organize and get out the vote, and their fielding of blue-collar candidates who can relate to working-class voters, many of whom voted for Trump. And joining us now is Asher Rangappa, who's Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and related courses at Wesleyan University, the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, and the University of New Haven. And previously, she served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City, and now is a political analyst at CNN. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asher Rangappa.
Thank you.
So we're learning, of course, that Attorney General Jeff Sessions was questioned for some time by the special counsel, Robert Mueller. But prior to that, we learned that Attorney General Sessions had been leaning on the FBI director, Christopher Wray, to replace the deputy director of the FBI, Andrew McCabe, and the former FBI general counsel, James Baker, both of whom Comey confided in after he had met with Trump when Trump leaned on him to go easy on General Flynn. So those two presumably are witnesses in a possible obstruction of justice case. So it seems pretty clear, is it not, that President Trump is basically leaning on those investigating him and going after the investigators rather than cooperating with them?
Well, this is the second time that we're seeing him trying to interfere somewhat directly with the FBI, the first time, of course, being with his conversations with Jim Comey and then, of course, firing him. And as you mentioned, Ian, this is especially problematic because the two people you mentioned, Andrew McCabe, who is the deputy director at the FBI, and Jim Baker, who was the general counsel at the FBI and is now in a different division, are both likely to be witnesses in an obstruction of justice investigation about the firing of Jim Comey, because as you said, Comey would have spoken with them immediately after his conversations with the president, which he documented, and anything that he said to these two people could corroborate his version of events, which, as you know, the president vehemently denies that he tried to encourage Comey to lay off the Russia investigation, for example. So it's incredibly problematic, and I think that it goes to an attempt by the White House to try to coerce the FBI to conform to the political narrative that it is really putting out there, which is that the FBI is corrupt, you know, can't be trusted, is biased. And of course, if Ray had fired these two individuals, they could have pointed to it and said, aha, see, we told you, our appointee, Christopher Ray, agrees with us. And it sounds like Christopher Ray stood his ground and refused to do that, probably because, by all accounts, these two individuals are very highly regarded in the FBI for their investigative reputations and their ethics, and he did not believe that they were that they deserved to be fired. So, yes, it's incredibly troubling, to say the least.
But it is clearly the entire narrative of Trump's defense, and it fits into it, doesn't it? Basically, what Trump is saying is that the Russia investigation is bogus, and it's ginned up by the Democrats, who are sore losers, and they don't want to accept his victory, so they're trying to diminish his authenticity as an elected president. And so he's going after people that supports that narrative, not whether or not it's true. I mean, when it certainly appears not to be true. So this is what I find extraordinary, is that the president is successfully creating a fictional version of what happened in order to frustrate the real version of what happened, which is being investigated.
Yes, well, I think we want to parse out a couple of things. So remember that the Russia investigation, the investigation into Russian interference in the election, is really separate and severable from the obstruction of justice investigation. In other words, the Russia investigation could end tomorrow or nothing could come of it, but the obstruction of justice case would still stand, because obstruction of justice has to do with how did you behave about an ongoing investigation, regardless of the merits of that investigation. They're two different things. And the firing piece is really relevant, I think, to the obstruction of justice case, because as I mentioned, McCabe and Jim Baker will be key witnesses. And by discrediting them, if that's what he was trying to do by trying to get them fired, by being able to point to them and see they're liars, you can't believe anything they say, they're untrustworthy, he's essentially trying to undermine the obstruction case against him. And in my opinion, that is the far bigger problem he has to worry about. Because right now, as you know, shady as the Russia investigation is becoming, with all of these players, we don't have anything that is directly linking the president. We don't have a smoking gun. And already, you know, linking the president to an intelligence operation, you know, that becomes trickier. You have to start looking at crimes like conspiracy and stuff. Obstruction of justice is pretty straightforward, and it's something that has been already introduced as an impeachable offense in America's history. So I think that is the one that he has to worry about, and that's the one that he is trying to discredit with as much effort as the Russia investigation.
And again, I'm speaking with Asha Rangappa, who's Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and related courses at Wesleyan University, the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, and the University of New Haven. And previously, she served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City, and is now a political analyst at CNN. But the extent to which Donald Trump's attacks on the FBI and his constant tweeting about McCabe and his wife, who ran for elective office as a Democrat in Virginia and lost, and he claims that Trump keeps claiming that they got money from Hillary. They got money actually from a couple of different sources, one of which was the governor at the time, Terry McAuliffe, but no, there's no evidence that there was actually any money coming from the Clintons. But that's the narrative that Donald Trump has established. But he's getting a lot of help from Republicans as well, who are also attacking the FBI, as you well know, and suggesting somehow that they're a bunch of closet Democrats and liberals. But the one person that the Republicans, congressional Republicans, are targeting is James Baker. And they're targeting him because they are trying to gin up this idea that somehow he was the guy that set up the connection between Mother Jones's David Corn and Christopher Steele of the explosive Trump-Russia dossier. So they are going after Baker in the way that they're going after the Russian story. That's pretty clear.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we can talk all day about what the Republicans are doing. I mean, at the end of the day, nothing, none of this is really going to have any bearing on Mueller's investigation. All of the, you know, public assassination of the FBI, et cetera, is just that. It's politics. And we have to remember that Robert Mueller, the special counsel, is proceeding. He's proceeding methodically. He's proceeding at a fast clip. He has a lot of information. He has a lot of witnesses. He has cooperating people that he's already indicted and who've pled guilty. And eventually, the cases will be made in a court of law. And at that point, if you know these, if the Trump's lawyers or whoever's caught up in this net want to go into a federal courthouse and accuse the FBI of lying or leaking or whatever they're doing, they're going to have to show actual evidence of that. Until then, what this is ultimately is just a lot of kabuki theater to, you know, basically play to their base. It's really sad because it is very delegitimizing in terms of upholding the rule of law and you know, the integrity of the institutions that are here to protect the United States. So that's unfortunate. But I think we do need to always remember that what these narratives are about are political narratives. They don't have legal meaning.
But they could have a real impact on the Mueller investigation if you consider what they're doing as a way to condition the base for the firing of Mueller. I mean, that's not out of the question, is it? That by delegitimizing Mueller and delegitimizing the FBI and trying to make it seem like a partisan attack on Trump's legitimacy as president, and somehow the FBI has become an enabler of this fictional attack, then it has real-world consequences. If Mueller goes, then what happens to the investigation?
Well, I think that's where Trump is going to learn the same lesson that he learned with Comey. If he fires Mueller, the investigation will still be there. This investigation is not wrapped up. Like, Mueller does not own this investigation any more than Comey owned the investigation. This is a part of the FBI and the Department of Justice, and I suspect that at this point there are likely many different cases on many different individuals, thousands of documents, of interviews, of intercepts, of information that's been shared with the United States, with its allies. This is located in the databases of the FBI and Department of Justice and probably in other intelligence agencies around the world. And so, you know, I think most people in the government understand that and what a huge mistake it would be for the president to fire Robert Mueller. He does have to go through several layers to try to do that. He has to get Rod Rosenstein to fire him and then fire Rod Rosenstein if Rod Rosenstein doesn't do it. That's deputy attorney general. So it would be a huge production, and it would ultimately be for naught. And I think that, so I disagree. I don't think this is about conditioning it for Robert Mueller, to fire Robert Mueller. I just think this is complete political theater.
Well, the other big story, along with the fact that the Attorney General spent several hours testifying before the special counsel, Robert Mueller, is that the New Yorker has a very extensive article by Adam Muntos and Evan Osnos about Jared Kushner. The title of it is Jared Kushner is China's Trump Card. And it makes the case that an influence campaign has been unleashed by the Chinese, particularly by their ambassador here in the United States, who obviously his career was in jeopardy because, like everybody else, he predicted a Hillary Clinton victory. But he's managed to redeem himself with his bosses in mainland China by carrying up a relationship with Jared Kushner. And apparently Jared Kushner was visited by the head of the FBI's counterintelligence head, who basically warned him that he was the target of an influence campaign, not just from China, but from other countries. We don't know the extent to which apparently they tried to also tell Donald Trump when he was making these phone calls or receiving phone calls in the transition period that there's a certain protocol to follow, which Trump apparently didn't follow. So we don't know what he said, what promises, what deals were made. But what's your understanding of how much this president and his son-in-law haven't followed the rules and perhaps even unwittingly have provided people like the Chinese and other countries with information that they shouldn't have.
Well, in the intelligence world, there's an acronym that's used to describe the motivations that intelligence agencies will exploit in order to get people to wittingly or unwittingly spy for them. And it's called MICE, and that stands for money, ideology, coercion, and ego. And generally, people's vulnerabilities, if you will fall into one of those, and intelligence agencies can identify those and exploit them. And I think that if you look at the president and you look at his son-in-law, money or greed is definitely something that's there. These are people who have consistently sought to make money whenever they can do it, perhaps without regard to the rules or ethics surrounding it. And ego is also something that appears to show up with a lot of people with, around the president himself. So, yes, you know, when you're an intelligence service and you see that there are people who are very susceptible to those things, you can essentially get them to play along with you without even having to say it out loud, or perhaps even without having your targets know that they're doing it. So it's not surprising to me. We've seen this, you know, at least we know for a fact that the Russians made attempts to contact Jared Kushner, for example, and he didn't call the FBI. That's something that any normal person would do in the circumstances that were present in that situation. And, you know, he sought to get political advantage for his father-in-law. So I'm not really surprised at all that other intelligence agencies would also see these same people as potential targets.
Well, apparently there's a protocol that all other presidents follow during the transitions when they do get phone calls from all kinds of people. Obviously, everybody wants to curry favor with the new president. And apparently in these phone calls that are made or returned, there's usually a national security officer along with a State Department official, you know, explaining the protocol that basically the president-elect can accept congratulations, but little else, because he's not the president. This president apparently didn't follow those rules, and all kinds of people were coming in. As you know, that was what the unmasking was about, because this character from the Emirates, MBZ, showed up secretly without letting the State Department know he was in the country for secret meetings with Trump's people and the former head of the mercenary army, the brother of the Secretary of Education, Eric Prince. So all kinds of strange stuff going on. The most extraordinary one of all is the fact that apparently Jared Kushner was advised by FBI counterintelligence to be wary of his relationship with Wendy Deng, the former wife of Rupert Murdoch. Apparently, she had an affair with Tony Blair, which was the reason why they divorced. And presumably, if there was some pillow talk involved in that, that Chinese may well have gotten some good secrets out of Tony Blair. So that is something that's out there. What do you know about that?
I honestly don't have anything to add on that front. I've been really bogged down with all of the FBI stuff today, so that's just not something. I'm really sorry that I have anything additional to add beyond what I've said, that, you know, Jared to me would be a typical target, given his access, given his vulnerability, given his probable willingness to go along with things and take ethical shortcuts and probably not report things as he's required to.
Well, Asha Rangappa, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, no problem. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Asha Rangappa, who's the Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and related courses at Western University, the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, and the University of New Haven. And previously, she served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City, and is now a political analyst at CNN. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the FBI investigation into whether Russian money went to the NRA to help Trump.
That you want me to do? Yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you got to tell the truth, yeah? Baby, why don't you tell me the truth now? You know you got me going everything crazy that you want me to do.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Peter Stone, a special correspondent for McClatchy DC Bureau, who since 1990 has covered a wide array of lobbying, legal, and campaign finance issues in Washington. He is the author of Casino Jack and the United States of Money, Super Lobbyist Jack Abramoff, and The Buying of Washington. And he has an article at McClatchy with Greg Gordon, FBI investigating whether Russian money went to NRA to help Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Stone.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Peter. And the story that you've broken is getting a lot of attention. Congressman Ted Lieu, in a radio interview, said, "The rumors I've heard on Capitol Hill are that the NRA Kremlin story is going to get bigger." What's your sense of whether this is going to get some legs, and certainly whether or not the special counsel, Robert Mueller, is looking into this issue?
Well, we believe the special counsel is looking into it because the FBI activity looking into torsion falls under his purview. So it seems there's no doubt that this is part of the special counsel's probe at this stage. Whether or not it gets legs is still to be determined. I mean, the investigation is into torsion. A well-known banker, very powerful, who's close to Putin, and has been linked to money laundering in a Spanish investigation several years ago. They're trying to determine whether or not he actually funneled money through the NRA to help Trump. That is something that they have some information about, apparently, but we don't know how much they have at this stage. We know that it is being scrutinized, but in terms of the extent of the information they have, the extent of the evidence, that's still to be determined.
And Alexander Torshin, as you mentioned, he's a longtime ally of Vladimir Putin. He previously served as a top senator in the Russian Duma. His connections came up in investigations by Spanish authorities into money laundering, where they did intercepts where Alexander Torshin had instructed members of the Moscow-based Taganskaya crime syndicate how to launder their ill-gotten gains through Spanish banks and properties. And he's heard on tape being referred to as the boss or the godfather. So Torshin himself may be a part of that kind of nexus, the so-called Siloviki in Moscow, oligarchs who are both close to Putin and close to organized crime.
Right. Well, he's denied any connection, and he's also said he was not involved with money laundering. But the Spanish in 2013 did wind up looking into a associate of Torshin's who was subsequently tried and pled guilty in 2016. This was a gentleman named Romanov who was based in Spain and who referred, as you said, to Torshin as boss or godfather in a number of tapes which Spanish prosecutors have. Romanov was convicted and sentenced to almost 4 years in jail in 2016. It's been reported elsewhere in a Spanish paper last year that Spain was actually on the verge of arresting Torshin. They had some information that he was due to fly into Mallorca for a party in 2013, and they were set to arrest him if he set foot on Spanish soil. Apparently, Torshin was tipped off and didn't come. But as we said, Torshin has denied any connection, and the Spanish did not bring charges against him because they had no access to getting him, no extradition treaty of any kind with Russia. But the report is fairly damning based on what we've seen and what Bloomberg first reported on this investigation in 2016.
Do we know who
The NRA connection is very interesting. Torshin is a lifetime member of the NRA. He first went to an NRA convention in 2013. A lot of the relationship was apparently nurtured by the then president of the NRA, David Keene, who had met him a couple years prior to 2013. And not only was he a lifetime member, but he then went to a few conventions, including in 2016, when he met Donald Trump Jr. very briefly, as has been reported. He tried to broker a meeting with Trump, the candidate. That didn't happen. That was nixed, the idea of a meeting directly with Trump and Torsion during the NRA convention in Kentucky in 2016. He did also, though, host a big NRA delegation in Moscow in December of the previous year. That delegation was over there for about a week. It included some top NRA fundraisers. And David Keene spearheaded that, the former NRA president who subsequently stepped down. And that's come to the eyes of investigators as well.
And again, I'm speaking with Peter Stone, a special correspondent for McClatchy DC Bureau, who since 1990 has covered a wide array of lobbying, legal and campaign finance issues in Washington. He is the author of Casino Jack and the United States of Money, Super Lobbyist Jack Abramoff and the Buying of Washington. And he has an article at McClatchy with Greg Gordon, FBI investigating whether Russian money went to NRA to help Trump. So the NRA convention that you mentioned in Louisville, Kentucky in May of 2016, that's when Donald Trump was endorsed by the NRA. They may have spent up to $70 million on Trump's presidential bid. At this point, they say they spent $55 million, $30 million which went to Trump. But a lot of this is dark money. But in response to the endorsement, Donald Trump said, "You came through for me, and I am going to come through for you." He promised the NRA at its 2017 convention, "I will never, ever let you down." Now, at the 2016 convention in Louisville, when Trump accepted the endorsement, I thought Torsion actually shared a table with Donald Jr. So he must have had more than just a passing acquaintance there. At least they had some time to chat
over. Reports have been conflicting about that. Uh-huh. I didn't verify that he shared a table. I think Bloomberg originally reported that he did.
Right.
He was at the table with him.
Right.
I heard from Trump Jr.'s lawyer that they met in a dinner environment when they were apparently, according to Trump Jr.'s lawyer, who I quoted, he explained that they were sitting in separate rooms, but they were introduced there, and that they had a few minutes of small talk, according to the lawyer, gun-related small talk, he described it as.
Right.
But either way, we don't know the extent of their conversation there. We do know that they did meet in person, and we do know that through an intermediary, Torsion did try to have a meeting with the candidate in Kentucky. That didn't happen. We also know that he even suggested that Trump and Putin might meet during 2016, an idea which Torsion helped to float, but that didn't happen either. Last year, Torsion has come to Washington for a number of years as the head of a delegation, Russian delegation, to the prayer breakfast, the National Prayer Breakfast, which is an annual event in early February, typically. President Trump in 2017 spoke at the National Prayer Breakfast, and there were plans underway, reportedly, for Torsion to meet briefly. He was trying to get a meeting with the president, and there was something scheduled, apparently, according to other reports, and it was killed. Again, Yahoo broke this story several months ago. It was killed at the last minute when apparently people in the White House were nervous over his Torsion's reported mob connections. So they didn't get FaceTime in 2017.
Well, Torsion, of course, is the head of the Russian gun group called Right to Bear Arms, which is Russia's attempt to create an NRA. The Russian people have not responded to the idea of everybody packing guns, but this religious connection also is a little extraordinary. But then Putin himself is very close to the arch-conservative Orthodox Church and has used religion as a way to create kind of a new form of right-wing patriotism in Russia.
Right. Well, that's true. Some of that has been documented. The Right to Bear Arms, which Torsion helped to start in 2013, is actually run by a protege of his, a young woman named Maria Butina. And Keene was over there officially at their opening, one of their opening ceremonies, with another conservative named Paul Erickson, who's been a longtime NRA member. And they went over to talk to an early meeting of the Right to Bear Arms and met Torsh. Well, they met Butina for that first time, and apparently Torsion was there at that meeting too. The group is a little bit ironic or odd because, as you noted, the private ownership of guns is not looked at very favorably by the Russian government. It doesn't seem to have much influence. It seems like a rather small group. But they were the ones who officially played host for the NRA delegation in 2015 when they went over there for a week. And Torsion was, according to one of the members of the delegation I spoke to, hosted a couple lavish dinners for them. They also went to a Russian gun company, visited a Russian gun company. And some of the delegation got a visit with the Deputy Minister of Defense in Russia, a high-level official named Rogozin. Some of the delegation, Keene and one or two other people, met with Mr. Rogozin. So it was apparently a very well-arranged tour for these folks. The gentleman I spoke to, a Californian, Dr. Goldschlager from Northern California, described it as a people-to-people mission and said it exceeded his expectations by, quote, logarithmic levels, he told me.
Well, I heard that there was a considerable amount of vodka and debauchery involved as well.
They had fancy meals. They had fancy meals.
All right. Well, we'll leave it at that.
Mr. Goldschlager referred to it as a, you know, quite a lot of Russian good food and vodka.
Right.
That's how he described it.
So the point, though, surely, Peter Stone, and this is why your investigation, along with Greg Gordon, is so important, is that it's against the law for foreign companies or foreign entities to funnel money into U.S. elections. And if we don't know how much money came from Torsion, but we do know that up to $70 million was funneled into the election by the NRA. And that is also done through dark money vehicles, these 501c4s. The NRA is considered a social welfare organization under the IRS rules. So that's the significance of this story, surely.
Right. Well, we don't know. As I say, the investigation is trying to determine whether Torsion funneled money. That's not been established, but that's what they're looking into. Mm-hmm. And so if they conclude that, it would definitely be illegal because it's illegal for foreigners to spend money to try to influence an election. And I think that's what the tips or the evidence that the FBI has that they're digging into obviously would be significant if they pan out.
Well, what is very suspicious, and it's sort of somewhat related in the sense that Russia seems to be still involved in our politics and in the same kind of meddling that they were involved in the last election, the use of troll farms and Russian bots, because the Russian bots are actively promoting hashtag Schumer shutdown in helping Trump in this current battle over the blame game over the government shutdown. So I find that pretty extraordinary. And I've talked to a number of people, including some intelligence people, who've made the point that maybe the explanation for why Trump hasn't done anything about the Russians and the Republicans haven't done anything, even though the Democrats put out a report, the Republicans wouldn't sign onto the report, recommending that the U.S. focus on protecting its 2018 and 2020 elections. The reason that could be, and a very cynical one at that, is that the Russians helped them out in 2016, so why not have them help them out in 2018 and 2020? At the very least, if the Russians are still using bots and troll farms to promote Trump's agendas, isn't that pretty extraordinary, not to mention suspicious?
Well, it has been documented that they are still, in operation. They still are busy at different times with messages of that seem to tilt toward Republicans. There are some Republicans who have voiced a lot of concern about Russian interference. Rubio, Senator Rubio being one of them, and others. And I don't think there's a unanimous front on this issue. I think Trump's message, the president's message, has been to obviously to downplay concerns about this and to often deny information that he's gotten from intelligence agencies that agreed unanimously that Russia did play a role in meddling in our election. A number of Republicans, including Congressman Nunes, seem to be doing their best to back up the White House on this and to change the subject. So there are divisions in the Republican Party on this, and obviously it's a highly charged issue now where the White House feels threatened by the investigations, and a lot of people are remaining silent, unfortunately, on things like continued Russian interference at this time.
Well, they certainly didn't cooperate with the Democratic report. That in itself, I think, says a lot. But that's always been the puzzlement from day one, why Donald Trump didn't want to clear his name and basically have a in-depth investigation into the Russian thing to remove the cloud of suspicion over his legitimacy. So that suspicion lingers. I thank you for joining us, Peter Stone.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
A pleasure. And again, bye-bye. I've been speaking with Peter Stone, who's a special correspondent for McClatchy DC Bureau, who since 1990 has covered a wide array of lobbying, legal and campaign finance issues in Washington. He is the author of Casino Jack and the United States of Money, Super Lobbyist Jack Abramoff and the Buying of Washington. And he has an article at McClatchy with Greg Gordon, FBI investigating whether Russian money went to NRA to help Trump. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into a new report, From the Bargaining Table to the Ballot Box, Political Effect of Right-to-Work Laws.
I know my destiny. It's like the sun. You see the best of me when I have got my gun. I work for the union, 'cause she's so good to me, and I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say, for he's the one who hands me down my pay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Alexander Hertel Fernandez, a professor of international and public affairs at Columbia University and the author of Politics at Work, How Companies Turn Their Workers into Lobbyists, as well as a manuscript in progress entitled State Capture, How Conservative Activists, Big Businesses, and Wealthy Donors Reshaped the American States and the Nation. He is a co-author of the new study at the National Bureau of Economic Research, From the Bargaining Table to the Ballot Box, Political Effect of Right-to-Work Laws. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Hertel Fernandez.
Thanks so much for having me.
And just to, before we begin the conversation, can we put it in a broader context, in as much as the amount of the workforce that is represented by labor unions has diminished over the decades, and it's down now to about 7% of the private workforce from the halcyon days of the American dream in the 1950s, when I believe the union representation was around between 30 and 40% of the workforce, was it not?
That's right.
So clearly, the Democratic Party, that used to depend upon union money enormously, has over the years shifted as the money has dried up and have now become more dependent upon the same people that the Republicans get their money from, which is big corporations and Wall Street.
That's definitely part of the story, but as our paper shows, to some degree, Democrats are not replacing the money and manpower that they used to get from unions, that there is a gap that has emerged, and that has had consequences for their electoral performance.
So it's not just money. It's people that knock on doors and drive elderly folk to the polls.
Absolutely. And in addition to that, unions also help cultivate political candidates themselves. And another finding from our paper is that when unions are weaker, blue-collar workers, who political science research suggests tend to be more progressive on economic issues, those sorts of blue-collar workers are less likely to be elected to state and national office.
So to some extent, does this relate to the current situation now where you've got a lot of progressive Democrats fuming at Chuck Schumer because the centrists made a deal with the Republicans? And you do have this obvious split in the Democratic Party to the centrists that are more business friendly and the progressives who are more, you know, involved with identity politics and a little less interested in, in fact, some are hostile to Wall Street. And what's happened as a result, as we saw in the last election, that many working class Americans voted for Trump. So it's pretty extraordinary to think that the party of the working class, to some extent, has lost the working class.
Yes, I think you're seeing those tensions within the Democratic Party now. And it's worth noting that the Democrats have had opportunities in the past to bolster the labor movement, perhaps most notably in the 1970s, and then again at the start of the Obama administration, there were efforts to pass legislation that would have made it easier for unions to organize and recruit members. And the Democrats punted both times and weren't able to pass labor organizing reform. And as we show, my co-authors and I indicate that this has come at an electoral consequence for the an electoral price for the Democrats.
So let's talk about your new study then, Alexander Hurtle Fernandez, at the National Bureau of Economic Research, From the Bargaining Table to the Ballot Box, Political Effect of the Right to Work Laws. First of all, here in the state of California, there is an important case before the Supreme Court. It was held up in that 4-4 split, but now that Gorsuch is on the court, it's going to be revisited. I believe it was a right-wing California public school teacher from Orange County or San Diego, I'm not sure, who was supported by one of these Koch brothers fronts. And she brought this case, which essentially will cripple public employee unions' ability to donate to the Democratic Party here in the state of California. So that is yet another one. It's not a right to work change in the law, but it's certainly a part of that overall mix. So it seems to me that the conservative movement and the big donors like the Koch brothers and corporations, etc., have had a fairly concerted program to change the laws over the decades, and what's happening now before the Supreme Court with this California case is just the latest example.
That's right. I think that's a fair characterization. I think that a number of conservative activists and donors have recognized the strategic importance of the labor movement for Democrats and for progressive policies in particular, and also have come up with a menu of ways to try and weaken the labor movement and therefore make it harder for Democrats to win and hold office and pass left-leaning redistributive legislation. At the end of our paper, we actually cite a donor proposal that was circulated by the State Policy Network, which is a group of right-leaning free market conservative think tanks across the states, where they are talking to donors about the effects of legislation like Right to Work, but also bills like the ones that passed in Wisconsin and Iowa that make it harder for public sector employees to bargain and negotiate with the state and attract new members. And they talk about how these bills will have the very concrete political consequences of making it harder for their opponents to win. So I think this is a very, very deliberate effort, as you outlined, from the right.
And again, I'm speaking with Alexander Hurtle Fernandez, a professor of international and public affairs at Columbia University and the author of Politics at Work, How Companies Turn Their Workers into Lobbyists, as well as a manuscript in progress entitled State Capture, How Conservative Activists, Big Businesses, and Wealthy Donors Reshaped the American States and the Nation. He is a co-author of the new study at the National Bureau of Economic Research, From the Bargaining Table to the Ballot Box, Political Effect of Right to Work Laws. So let's go through then what your paper has discovered in terms of how these right-to-work laws have affected Democratic turnout, Democratic donations, the ability to get Democrats elected, the kind of candidates they're getting elected, which tend to be more middle-class professional and less blue-collar, So let's walk through the results that your study has discovered.
Great, and I should also say that my two co-authors and I contributed equally to the paper, so we don't have a lead author on the paper. But in our work, we looked at so-called right-to-work laws, which are state-level decisions that change the way that unions can collect dues from workers who work at a unionized shop or a unionized employer. And in a state like California that does not have a right-to-work law, if you are a worker at a unionized company or employer, you have to contribute dues to that union even if you are not a member, because that union is legally required to include you in its collective bargaining agreement. And, you know, if you're fired or punished in some way, the union is required to represent your interests legally. And so the idea is that states like California have decided that it's only fair that you, as someone who's benefiting from these union protections, should have to kick in some dues. Now, the law says that the unions can't charge you for political contributions. It can only be the sort of workplace issues, but you still have to kick something over to the union. Now, in right-to-work states, workers do not have to pay any contributions to unions, even if they work at a unionized employer and they're benefiting from the collective bargaining agreements that unions put forward or the grievance protections that unions develop with managers. And as we show in the paper, this creates a free rider problem. Why should workers have to contribute to a union if they can benefit from that union without paying any dues? And this forces unions, as we show in the paper, to focus less attention on politics and more attention on shoring up their membership, because unions are trying to keep their membership numbers up after these laws pass. And we show that that reallocation of resources away from politics has big effects on Democrats at the ballot box. So we look at counties that are straddling a state border, where one state is right to work, and unions have to sort of make these tough decisions between membership and politics, and non-right to work states like California. And so we look at these county borders, and we look at what happens to Democratic candidates for the presidency, for governorships, for the state house, and for state legislatures, and we track how many votes Democrats receive and how much turnout you see. And we see that after right to work passes, that Democrats are less likely to gain votes, and turnout also drops. And so we conclude that this is a result of those laws that are weakening unions' abilities to participate in politics.
But this onslaught against the unions in states that still have union representation and right-to-work states, it's an ongoing campaign. I mean, for the longest time, states in the South were right-to-work and still are right-to-work states. And I've noticed recently these transplanted European and Japanese car manufacturers like Mercedes and Toyota, et cetera, have built plants in these right-to-work states, and efforts to unionize have been frustrated by enormous propaganda campaigns and also well-funded anti-union campaigns.
That's right. So as I alluded to earlier, I think right to work is just one item on a menu that conservative activists and donors are putting forward in the states. Right to work is one way of hampering the labor movement, but you're also seeing efforts to stop new unionizing. Like you mentioned, I think of the drive to stop unionization at a new VW plant in the South that attracted a lot of attention. And I also think about new legislation that passed in states like Wisconsin and Iowa that makes it harder for public sector unions to organize and bargain with a state. You know, Iowa, for instance, has long been a right to work state, but it's only recently that the GOP state government has tried to make it harder for their public sector unions to organize.
So this is a pretty relentless assault, isn't it? If you're a union member or a union officer, there's no rest, is there? You're constantly basically trying to hold on to your members.
That's right, although I think there's some promising signs from Congress in the sense that Democrats have recently shifted to start talking about the importance of unions, and you saw a handful of Democratic senators, including Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown and my own New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, sponsoring legislation that would ban right-to-work laws across the state. So it's not a obviously going to go anywhere when Republicans can control Congress and Trump is in the White House, but you can sort of see that this is becoming part of an agenda that Democrats might pursue if they were to retake Congress and the White House.
But you mentioned earlier that they had their opportunity some time ago in the 70s, and when the Democrats controlled all branches of government, as the Republicans do now. Give us some background on those missed opportunities.
I think one key missed opportunity was at the start of the Obama administration. Unions kind of went into the Obama administration holding their heads high because they had contributed pretty significantly to his election in 08. A bunch of the ground operation that unions contributed ended up helping get Obama over the finish line in a number of states, and they were hoping that in exchange for that strong support that the Obama administration would prioritize union reform. And they did control majorities, including a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate at that time. Unfortunately, there were a lot of other issues on the agenda, including passing a stimulus bill to help the economy that was in free fall at that point, health reform, which was already well underway, and, of course, financial regulation of the banks and climate change legislation were all up for debate at that time. And given that crowded agenda, it was easy for labor reform to sort of slip through the cracks, particularly since there were a number of Democrats who were uneasy about passing that legislation then. Although, as I alluded to before, I think you're seeing a shift in the Democratic Party in a more leftward direction since then. So I'm a little bit more optimistic from the perspective of labor reform now than I was probably then, should Democrats gain control of Congress and the White House again.
Well, I remember meeting with the head of the SEIU, and he said, you know, we gave Obama $85 million. That's not chump change.
No, and even more importantly, they contributed a lot of grassroots mobilizers who went out and knocked on doors to get people to the polls.
Well, is there a recognition, though, because of what happened with Trump? And it's pretty extraordinary how the Democrats blew it and how Hillary Clinton didn't campaign in those three key states where she lost: Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, certainly at the last minute, in spite of urging from her husband and Bernie Sanders. Why they didn't put Bernie Sanders on the ticket, I don't understand. I mean, one of the most amazing things that Bernie Sanders showed was that there's a huge constituency out there amongst the young and the working class that can get behind progressive politics and a progressive agenda. And I guess that hasn't died in spite of the compromise that we just saw in the Senate brought about by the centrist Democrats. What's your sense of the future of the progressive wing, even though it's to some extent consumed by identity politics? It's the last vestige of the Democratic Party that seems to care about working Americans. I mean, I don't believe that the centrists are focused on that. You know, if you get your money from Wall Street, I suspect that you're not going to be such an ardent proponent of workers' rights.
I think a number of progressive politicians, and even I would go so far as to say more moderate Democrats, now recognize the importance of pursuing reforms that are going to shore up the position of Democrats going into subsequent elections. And one of those sets of reforms include things to expand the labor movement, which I think would bolster Democrats in the long run. But, you know, I think you're also seeing a helpful focus on expanding access to the franchise and the ballot box in terms of making it easier for people to vote. A number of states under Democratic control are making it easier for people who have already served their time to regain access to the franchise, or to pass laws that make voter registration universal and automatic, or even voting by mail. I think all of those things, coupled with labor reform, bolster the position of Democrats, because not only is it good policy to expand access to the franchise, but it also has the potential of being electorally beneficial for the Democrats.
Well, I'm, you know, even though there's a lot of optimism about a blue wave sweeping the Republicans out of control in both the House and the Senate, I'm a little more sanguine about it. I think the Republicans could hold on to power. They're pumping this narrative of this booming economy and this runaway stock market. and they may be able to sort of keep their base in line and again win over the working class voters by suggesting that somehow trickle-down economics is going to improve their lot and make America great again. And it would seem that what's going on with these corporations now giving out these token bonuses is an example of how they can play that game.
There's obviously no guarantee that Democrats will necessarily enjoy a big wave in these upcoming elections, but certainly some of the structural features of the American political system are in their favor. But of course, it's up to the Democrats to take advantage of those advantageous conditions and field quality candidates in a number of races and ensure that they're running on issues that resonate with majorities of voters. Of course, as you well noted, there are uphill obstacles, and I think the fact that unions are no longer there to buttress Democrats in a number of these key states is a key structural obstacle going into the next cycle of elections. I think 5 Democratic senators are up for re-election next cycle in states that have become right-to-work since 2012, and our research suggests that those candidates will have an uphill battle, given that they can't count on as much money or voters turned out as they might have in the absence of those right-to-work laws.
And the point that you make is that because of this trend to destroy unions, blue-collar candidates are not running. And so you've got a billionaire running as a populist who cons a bunch of working people into believing he cares about them when he doesn't care about anybody but himself. So you'd think that somebody on the political left could come up with a working man who could, Randy Bryce, I know, is running in Wisconsin against Paul Ryan. He fits that category. Just in the last minute, what's your sense of the candidate landscape?
That's right. We find that unions are really important to contributing to greater class diversity in who serves in state legislatures and in Congress. And here we build on the terrific work of a political scientist, Nicholas Carnes at Duke, who shows that blue-collar workers who go on to serve in political office are more progressive on economic issues in particular than are folks who come from a more white-collar background. And so if progressive activists want to move the Democratic Party to the left, getting better class representation among the people who are running for office seems like a good first step.
Well, Alexander Hurdle-Fernandez, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Alexander Hurdle-Fernandez, who's a professor of international and public affairs at Columbia University and the author of Politics at Work, How Companies Turn Their Workers into Lobbyists, as well as a manuscript in progress entitled State Capture, How Conservative Activists, Big Businesses, and Wealthy Donors Reshaped the American States and the Nation. He is a co-author of the new study at the National Bureau of Economic Research, From the Bargaining Table to the Ballot Box, Political Effect of Right-to-Work Laws. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.